The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
Sometimes it's the normal, sometimes it's the abnormal, and sometimes it's the paranormal, but it's always Beyond Reality Radio. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm your host, JV Johnson. We've got a great one lined up for you tonight. It's the 50th anniversary of the Sharon Tate murder by the Charles Manson family. This is quite a story, and most of us know it because it's part of American legend, urban legend in some cases. But what we do know is that four members of the Manson family snuck into the home of Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski, the famous film director. And Polanski wasn't in the home at the time, but Sharon Tate was with three other people, and they were brutally and savagely murdered. Our guest tonight, JC Nova, is the host of a podcast called Death by Misadventure, and we're going to be talking about the Sharon Tate murder, the Manson family, and what happened exactly 50 years ago tonight in California in that home. So it'll be a very interesting conversation, and I'm anxious to do it. We've had JC on the program before. We talked about the 27 Club with JC last time. We were talking about the number of rock and roll musicians who died at an early age of 27 years old and how mysteriously some of that occurred. So she's a great guest, and I'm really looking forward to having her back. Tomorrow night, just a reminder, is a best-of program. And then Monday, we've got another really terrific true crime story for you. Reporter and author John Hook will be here. He's written a book called Who Killed Bob Crane, and we'll be talking about the unsolved 1978 murder of the star of Hogan's Heroes. Some people think, actually, prosecutors and investigators think they know exactly who did it. They just could not prove it in a court. But it's a great and very, very interesting story. In fact, it is the epitome of sex, lies, and videotape. If you know anything about Bob Crane, you know what I'm talking about. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you'll hear the story when we talk with John Hook Monday night. Tuesday, we've got a paranormal friend and a bit of a legend in the paranormal community, Jeff Belanger. You remember, we've had him on talking about Krampus around holiday time. He's going to come on Tuesday night and talk about stories from New England, legends about cryptids and other odd activity and occurrences in New England. He's got a podcast about the topic, and that will be our discussion on Tuesday night with Jeff Belanger. So a lot of great things coming up on the program. If you have not found the Beyond Reality Radio coffee mug yet, if you're not holding it right now and using it to drink whatever beverage you are drinking while you listen to this program, well, you're really missing out. Go to the website, Beyond Reality Radio. .com, and you'll see the mug there. You can click on the link. The shipping is free domestically, and we'd love to ship one out to you. So stop by the website, beyondrealityradio.com, and get yourself a coffee mug. Makes a great gift as well. We'll take a break. When we come back, we will bring in our guest, JC Nova, tonight. We're talking about the Sharon Tate murders by the Manson family. It's Beyond Reality Radio.
Did you know that online retailers like Amazon have constant deals that can save you money on the things you buy every day? It's no joke. Save 40%, 50%, even 80% on great products. And all you have to do is know about them. Noodle Shark is the way to be alerted when something good is coming your way. Noodle Shark is the social media page that lists great deals that not only save you money, but give you the deals before anyone else has them. All you have to do is find Noodle Shark on Facebook. Search it as The Noodle Shark. That's The Noodle Shark, because you deserve to save too. Become a shark and save.
Welcome back to Beyond Reality Radio. Some of the times we talk about stories or topics that are a bit macabre. Tonight is going to be one of those. Because late night on August 8th of 1969, four Manson family members were directed to go to, quote, that house where Melcher used to live and totally destroy everyone in it, as gruesome as you can, end quote. Those instructions came from Charlie Manson, and they were given to Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Linda Kasabian, and Patricia Krenwinkel. And they followed those instructions and made their way to 10050 Cielo Drive, a home that had been rented by film director Roman Polanski and his pregnant wife Sharon Tate. At the home that night were Tate and three of her friends, all of whom were unknown and completely unfamiliar with Manson and his followers. Polanski was in London at the time. As the clock moved into the early hours of August 9th, 1969, 50 years ago, these very moments, the home turned into an unbelievable hell of murder and torture as all of the occupants of the house, including Tate and her 8.5-month-old unborn baby, were savagely murdered in what appears to have been a case of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Our guest tonight is a returning guest to the program, J.C. Nova, a psychic astrologer, but also a podcaster, host of a program called Death by Misadventure. J.C., welcome to back to Beyond Reality Radio. It's a pleasure to have you here tonight.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
We're going to be talking about some gruesome things tonight and a topic that may make some people a bit uncomfortable because it's one of those things where the truth is stranger than fiction and certainly more disgusting or disturbing than fiction in this case. But before we get there, this is an odd transition to make. What have you been up to since you're on the program last?
We're continuing to produce Death by Misadventure, which is basically a podcast that follows the infamous deaths of celebrities and rock stars. And so we recently just did one on Sharon Tate, and then prior to that was Wayne Staley. Also, I recently launched kind of a psychic guide type website called bestpsychics.com, B-E-S-T, and that's where people can go, where they can look at reviews of other psychics online. They can also find out information about different types of psychics, astrology, crystals, just a variety of information. And then we're going to be working on some unsolved murder mysteries starting in September.
The last time you were here, I believe we were talking about the 27 Club and the deaths of many rock and roll musicians that, for whatever reason, whatever the circumstances were, died at an early age of 27 years old.
Yeah, we were talking, I was on with Tom Dre, and we talked about the 27 Club, which is basically Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain, Amy Winehouse, several rock stars that died at the age of 27, which is, from an astrological perspective, it's a very significant time. People are just getting ready to go into their Saturn return, which is basically where a person is going into adulthood. But at that time, a lot of tragic circumstances can happen, and also a lot of positive ones. Lots of times people get married, they have children, they move. But for these particular rock stars during their life, even Jim Morrison, it was a very pivotal time for them. And it seemed like as we were researching each podcast, as we write the podcast and investigate what's going on, usually we find that most of them have some type of premonition that the end is near or something. There's going to be kind of a twist of fate. And also there was always some numerology aspect to it. Some people that follow numbers or mystical numbers. We found in a lot of these podcasts that we've written and produced, the number 6 comes up quite frequently, also along with the number 9 and the number 7. So it's kind of interesting. You start to see a pattern, and we saw the same with Sharon Tate as well.
When you say those numbers come up often, do they come up through a numerology standpoint whereby a numerologist will take the person's name and deduce those numbers? Or are you seeing them in things like addresses or phone numbers or just, numbers that happen to be affiliated with the story?
It's numbers like, for example, a person's life path number is based on the day that you were born, the month, the date, and the year.
Right.
And when you equal those numbers and reduce it to a single digit, that's your life path number. For example, for Sharon Tate, her life path number was a 6. For Roman Polanski, his life path number was a 6. Tex Watson's life path number was a 6. And the house that they lived at, 10050 Celio Drive, was a number 6 as well. So you have that 666 energy vibrating. So 6 can be a super positive number about family, love, and relationships. But when you start seeing that number frequently, and depending on what type of energy is going on around the person at the time or where they live, it can be a double-edged sword and can turn incredibly negative. And we've seen that in a pattern. I think we shared with you the story when we were on the show of Viola Beach, which is a British band that died in Sweden a few years ago in a freak accident. Their car drove off a bridge, and the manager and the whole band died. But it was like they died on the day number six. Like, all the band members' life paths were number six. Like, there was all this kind of strange, mystical, maybe people might say it's a coincidence, but we have seen a pattern as we've studied all these different stories.
Now, as you continue to evolve and mold your podcast, there seems to be an amazing surge in the number of people that are interested in true crime, particularly unsolved true crime. What's the fascination that seems to be taking our culture by hold?
Well, I think it's part of the unknown. I think for true crime stories, a lot of the true crime women, for whatever reason, tend to be one of the bigger audience. For our particular podcast, our main audience is, I think it's like 75% male and 25% female. I think it might be because we cover a lot of rock stars and bands and things like that. But I think people are always curious about the afterlife, and is it just, were you at the wrong place at the wrong time? Is it just a coincidence? Or there, do you have some karmic fate attached with that person? You know, what was going on in your life? People are trying to figure out, like, why did this terrible thing happen to this person? Could it have been avoided? Was there a warning? Did they feel like something bad might happen? And people are curious. People want to know what life has in store for them, but also what may be in store for them in the afterlife. Is there more than just what we see here on Earth? Is there a God? Are there ghosts? I think that's why people are fascinated with true crime and the paranormal.
As a psychic astrologer, what do you think of the afterlife? Do you have an opinion?
Yeah, actually, I do. I had a near-death experience at the age of four. I was on a church retreat, and I drowned, basically. Oh. And then this 16-year-old boy rescued me out of this cove and saved my life, basically. But at the time, I was like, I had this out-of-body experience where I saw myself drowning. And I was like, my friend that was with me, this little friend, she was trying to get people's attention to say, you know, hey, she's drowning. And no one would pay attention to her. And finally, these teenage boys saw me, and this one boy came and saved me. And since that time, I feel like all of us have psychic ability. And sometimes I've found that when people are involved in some type of tragic situation, or perhaps an accident, or involved in some type of trauma, it kind of lifts the veil so that you're more open to see the other side. I always feel connected with spirit since I was little. I was never afraid of death, but I was also raised in an environment that not to be afraid of it. I was more fascinated by it and communication with spirit. And even for, you know, when our family members or friends pass on, I do feel like that you still have a connection with that person. And I also feel like certain homes, like if somebody died in a house, it will leave a psychic imprint of that particular energy. And I think, you know, as the next 10, 20, 30 years, I think it'll be easier. More people will be able to communicate with the dead. More people, astrology and psychics will be part of everyday life.
We've got about a minute here before we have to go to our first break, and that's not enough time to start discussing the Sharon Tate murder. But I want to find out a little bit more about the podcast in that time. How frequently are you releasing the podcast, and where can people find it?
Okay, Death by Misadventure, you can go deathbymisadventure.co.uk is our website, but also the podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, CastBox, TuneIn. Right now, we typically do two episodes per month. We're working towards going towards a weekly episode starting in September. And so right now we probably have, I think we have 24 podcasts available, and it's a variety of rock stars to actresses to bands. Like we have one on Marilyn Monroe, Prince, Lane Staley, the 27 Club, Viper Room, just a variety of podcasts. So depending on your interest, I think you could find something that would be interesting. And each story is told from the investigative part, which is like just the facts. It's the true facts of what happened. And then we add a mystical element to it. We look at it from a supernatural perspective of what was going on from a spiritual perspective. And then if there were any conspiracies involved, and then we also look at after the fact, like where are the people now that were involved with that particular celebrity or rock star at the time of their death, and what are they doing now? And have there been any hauntings or any other, you know, strange, unexplained experiences since then?
Is it more common than not to have some type of paranormal activity associated with stories like this?
I think it's actually very common. It was interesting. When we finished the Lane Staley podcast, I'm a huge Alice in Chains fan, and his girlfriend had died a few years before he had passed away. And Mike Starr, his old bass player, had come to visit him. It happened to be, I guess it was Mike Starr's birthday. And at the time, Lane Staley was in full-blown heroin addiction and basically didn't really leave his house that much. But he had told Mike the last time Mike had seen him that he had that his ex-girlfriend had come to visit him the night before, you know, basically that she was going to take him into the afterlife, like she was visiting him. And so he was having this supernatural experience before he actually died. Mike Starr left that day, didn't see him again. And then I guess Lane Staley died like 24 hours later, but they didn't find him until 2 weeks later. So I've found a lot of these actors and musicians have all had some kind of weird supernatural or paranormal experience before they've passed.
We're talking about the Sharon Tate murders, which actually occurred 50 years ago this very minute, although it was West Coast, it was Pacific time. So I think you're in the West Coast, JC, right?
Yeah, I'm in Los Angeles, so it's 9:36 here.
9:30. And the murders occurred shortly after midnight into August 9th of 1969. So it's a few hours away to be that precise moment. Let's talk a little bit about who these people were. You know, many people hear the name Sharon Tate, but many people don't know who she was. Tell us who Sharon Tate was.
Yeah, Sharon Tate was, at the time she died, she was 26 years old. She was an actress, but she grew up in a military family. They bounced around from city to city and country to country. She actually went to high school in Italy. In high school, she was a cheerleader. She was prom queen. And she first started acting in films over in Italy at the time, doing extra work. And when she came back to the United States, she got a manager, and she was signed to a 7-year contract by MGM. And so that was pretty common in the 60s. A lot of actresses were signed to movie studios for a long period of time, and then the studio would basically, you know, choose films for them. And so she was 20 years old at the time when she started acting, but she really didn't have any breakout role until it was probably just a few years before she died. So it would have been right around 1965, just before she met Roman Polanski. And she had starred in the movie Valley of the Dolls, and she wanted to be in this movie that Roman Polanski was filming about vampires. And so her manager had taken her to London to introduce her to Roman Polanski. And at the time, he was considered one of the young, hot directors, and they actually lived right around the corner from each other in London. And I guess the first two times they met each other, it didn't go really well. And then the second time, once he got to know her a little bit better, he thought, oh, she's going to be perfect for the film. He cast her in the movie. They ended up falling in love and getting married. But at the time, the interesting thing about Roman Polanski is, though, even though he was brilliant, in the entertainment crowds and in the movie industry, people thought there was something like a little bit off about him. There were like lots of times, like when he was involved in certain movies, he was involved in drugs and had an interesting sexual life and all these crazy things that were happening with him. Lots of times people wouldn't work with him because of it, but Sharon didn't care. She fell in love and she wanted to get married. And so they ended up getting married. And at the time, he was going to be filming, I think it was called Day of the Dolphin in London. And so they were looking around for a house to rent. And so they rented the house in Benedict Canyon at 10050 Celio Drive. And that house was pretty famous because there was a lot of famous people that had lived in that house before. But more than anything, Terry Melcher, which was a music producer and the son of Doris Day, and his girlfriend at the time, Candace Bergen, if anybody knows who she is, she was on the TV show Murphy Brown, used to live there. And at the time, Manson was hoping to be a musician and had presented his music to Terry Melcher. And at one moment, he was thinking about possibly giving Manson a contract, but then decided against it. So Sharon and Roman moved into this house in February of 1969. And Sharon was pregnant, and they were like, oh, we're going to go live in this house. And then after the baby's born, we're going to figure out where we want to live and go buy a home. And at the time, Roman had this friend called Wojciech Frykowski, and they were friends in Poland since they were little boys. And actually, Wojciech's father gave Roman Polanski his break in the film industry and actually funded his first film. And his girlfriend was Abigail Folger, and Abigail Folger was the heiress to the Folger Coffee family. And so Roman had asked them, hey, you know, I have to go to London to film this movie. Do you guys mind moving in with Sharon and kind of keeping an eye on her while I'm gone? So they moved in to, you know, stay at the house, but also kind of keep an eye on Sharon. And she had this other friend, Jay Sebring, which was her ex-boyfriend. He was a big hairdresser in Hollywood, and he did all the celebrity hair. And even though their relationship didn't work out, they were really close friends. And so he was always there also. And the house became very famous for being like a party house, and it had an open door policy. People would come to the house all day, all night. There was parties, drugs, you name it, all kinds of crazy things going on at the house. And in our investigation, we found out that Manson had actually come to the house about a month after they had moved in looking for Terry Melcher. And Sharon was home at the time. And I think one of her maintenance people talked to him. He was looking for Melcher, and they told him, hey, he doesn't live here anymore. And Sharon was upset. She's like, oh, who's that creepy guy? Why is he coming here? And they were like, oh, you know, he's looking for Melcher. And then he left. And then there was a young kid, William Gerritsen, that was actually staying in the guest house and was considered the caretaker of the home at the time they were living there.
The home itself, it no longer stands. Is that correct?
Yeah, the house was torn down in 1994.
And I think another home has been built in its place. But before we get to talking about that part of it, I want to go back to the Roman Polanski angle to this, because the film that you were talking about that Sharon Tate wanted to be in, that Roman Polanski was casting, was called, I think, The Fearless Vampire Killers. And it was kind of a farcical comedy slash horror that Roman Polanski actually starred in as well. It's actually a movie I've enjoyed several times. And that was the film he did right before he did Rosemary's Baby, which was a very pivotal film in Polanski's career.
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
And then actually there's some connection with Rosemary's Baby to this story. So we know who Roman Polanski was. We know who Sharon Tate was. The two of them were married. I think it was in 1968, January of 1968. They'd been married a year. They move into this home in February of 69. And it was only a few short months later. Sharon Tate is now well into her eighth month almost 2 weeks from being full term in her pregnancy, and the unspeakable happens.
Right. The evening that happened, which we found, like, when we... book, and I thought, oh, you know, what else could I possibly find out about what happened to her? But I found out a lot of interesting information that I didn't know about her. She was very close with her family, and she had two little sisters that were actually her parents had her, and then they didn't have children again until Sharon was 9 years old. So her sisters were like 10 and 12 years younger than her. So at the time she was pregnant, they were teenagers. And so 2 weeks before she died, she had seen her family, and she went to see her family, and they watched the moon landing together. And then on the day of August 8th, her two sisters had called, and they wanted to come to her house and spend the night and have a sleepover. And at the time, Sharon wasn't feeling well, and she told them, you know, no, let's wait until after the baby's born. I'm not really feeling that great. So no, I don't want you to come over. I'm sorry, but you know, we'll do a rain check. So her two sisters then come that evening. She spoke to her friend Ava Roosevelt, which was an actress, and she invited her to go out to dinner with her and J. Sebring and Abigail Folger and Wojciech Frykowski. And so Ava was like, hey, you know, I've got these plans with a German producer. I can't make it, but maybe I can come over for a nightcap like around 10:30, you know, 10:45 at night. And Sharon's like, okay, great, no problem. So they all go out to dinner at El Coyote, which still exists today. It's a Mexican restaurant in Los Angeles on Beverly Boulevard. And so they go and they have dinner, and they leave the restaurant, I think it's right around 9:30, 9:45. They get home at 10:30 at night. And so right around 11:30 at night, Ava jumps in her car, and she's on her way to go over to Sharon's house to have a nightcap. And all of a sudden, her engine light starts to flicker. And so she's driving, and she's thinking, oh, my God, am I going to make it to the house? Because Benedict Canyon is kind of, like, far up the hill. And so she decided at 11:30 at night, no, I'm not going to go to Sharon's house. I'm just going to turn around and go home. So she goes home. So right after midnight, Tex Watson and the three other girls jump in their car, and they're going up to Benedict Canyon. And as you said in the introduction of the show, said, you know, just go in there, kill everybody, and, you know, make it wicked. Just destroy everyone in it. So they get to the house, and they run into a kid that had been visiting William Garrison, who was the caretaker. And so he was just leaving, and it just happened to be there. And so Tex Watson shot him, and I guess they found a window open at the mansion, and so he cut the screen out, and he climbed through the window, Tex Watson did, and then he was able to let the girls in. And then basically just all these, obviously they were murdered, and all these horrific things happened to him. But what was interesting is they kept saying, you know, Tex Watson saying, I'm the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business. And it was very kind of satanic in the way they killed him. And they didn't seem to have any remorse whatsoever. And there was this really interesting connection, sweet connection between Sharon Tate and J. Sebring, because they used to be boyfriend and girlfriend. And Tex had, like, tied them together. And Jay tried to protect Sharon, and in protecting her, they killed him first. And I just thought from a karmic perspective, from a spiritual perspective, Sharon Tate would always say in interviews, like, she believes in fate. She followed Wicca, and she just kind of, like, she believed that everything happened for a reason. And obviously what happened to them, nobody deserves that. But there was a lot of, in my opinion, a lot of dark energy in that house. They had a lot of wild parties there. In our research, Roman Polanski, you know, would force Sharon into some unusual sexual relationships that she didn't really want to participate in. So there was a lot of dark things that happened in that house. And I believe when you have that type of energy and then you're bringing in like the Manson followers into it, it just kind of collided together that evening, and it was just horrific. And after the killings, they escaped. And when the police came the next day, what was funny is, like, the cops were called, but the cops never showed up. They had received a phone call. The neighbors next door had heard gunshots, but never called the police. There was a camp counselor down the hill that was doing some camp for 70 kids, and he could hear a man screaming, and he called the police saying, hey, you know, there's something going on. A security guard heard the screams, called the cops. The cops never showed up that evening, and so the bodies were discovered by the maid. And so when the maid ran next door to the neighbor and they called the police, they finally showed up and obviously found everybody. But they didn't know at the time. They had no idea who killed Sharon and her friends, but they initially thought it was the guy that lived in the guest house. And he was high at the time and had no idea what was going on. And he was actually arrested for the murders and in jail for 2 days before they let him go. And when they let him go, they just had no idea who had killed her and her friends, and they didn't really discover it until a few months later after the Manson family was arrested for something completely different.
Our guest tonight, JC Nova, host of the podcast Death by Misadventure. She's also an astrologer and a psychic. And we're talking about the Sharon Tate murders. We were speaking specifically about the house, JC. We've just got a couple minutes in this segment. But from what I understand, the house no longer exists, but the property still seems to have some type of dark energy. And a gentleman by the name of David Oman, I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, he's been on the program before and has talked often about that area and that property. And his house, which sits very close, seems to have a similar dark energy. Do we know anything about the property? Is there a history there that might give an indication of why this energy might be there?
Well, he bought the mansion was torn down in 1994, and about 5 years afterwards, he bought a plot nearby for $40,000 to build a house with his father. And when they were doing construction on the home, his construction workers would hear voices and footsteps on the top floor, and they always felt like there was a spooky feeling, like they weren't alone. And they'd also hear voices, they'd get a cold breeze on their neck. And then in July of 2004, Oman had woke from a deep sleep around 2 o'clock in the morning, and he had seen basically a ghost at the bottom of his bed, and it was pointing towards the driveway, which led to the Manson murder site. And the ghost never spoke to him, but it kept pointing towards the driveway. And at the time, he was really fascinated, so he went down to the LAPD to try to figure out if there were, like, items left on the vacant lot where the house was, or if there was any bloody clothing or DNA. And so when he was looking through the photos, he saw a photo of J.C. Bring, and he said it bore an eerie resemblance to the figure that he had seen at his bedside. And to me, that was very telling, because as we studied the story, I mean, Jay was so in love with Sharon and was, you know, so protective of her. And in our research, it was showing that Roman and Sharon's marriage was on the rocks, basically, and she wasn't sure if she was going to stay with him or not based on all these strange things that were happening in their relationship. And I really feel like his spirit stayed behind, you know, trying to protect her and the energy around the house. And since that time, a lot of paranormal investigators have gone there. And one particular one, Barry Taff, basically called it the Mount Everest of haunted houses, or the Disneyland for dead. So the energy is very strong there, which would make sense because of what happened was so traumatic. And then in the trial of Linda Kasabian, because she actually didn't participate in the murder, she was like the getaway driver, but she did dispose of all the weapons, and she was dropping the weapons as they were taking off. So she was just kind of throwing them everywhere. And so there's a strong chance that some of the murder weapons were around the area that he had built his dad's home. Right. And even after the murders, the cops initially didn't find the murder weapons. Like, one kid found the gun, and, like, you know, the media had found other weapons. So they were just kind of thrown all over the place.
Our guest tonight is J.C. Nova. We'll bring her back in just a moment. Just a quick look ahead to what we've got coming up on the program. Tomorrow night will be a best of show. Monday, John Hook will be here, another true crime night. He is a reporter and the author of a book called Who Killed Bob Crane, one of Hollywood's great unsolved murders at this point. Although, if you ask any of the investigators and the prosecutors, they say it's been solved. They just couldn't get a conviction. Bob Crane, of course, the star of the TV series Hogan's Heroes, and his murder is nothing short of sex, lies, and videotapes. So, great conversation Monday night. I'm looking forward to that. And Tuesday, Jeff Belanger, he's an author, folklorist, and a podcast host, will come on to share stories from his New England Legends podcast, cryptid stories, ghost stories, and more that he talks about on his podcast. That's Jeff Belanger, Tuesday night. Like I said, tonight, J.C. Nova is with us. J.C., we're talking about the murders of Sharon Tate and three of her friends by the hands of four members of the Charles Manson family. Let's take a minute and talk about Charlie Manson. You know, this is a guy that we've seen pictures of with these very piercing eyes. Most of the pictures we've seen of him have been from prison, because that's where he spent the last 48 years anyway, because he died a couple years ago. But who was Charlie Manson, and why was he so magnetic?
Well, looking at Charlie Manson's chart, he had several planets in Scorpio. So he had that powerful magnetism, and he could see instantly, look at a person and see their weaknesses. And he tended to prey on people that were emotionally broken. And because he came from a broken home himself growing up, when he was a small child, his mother was an alcoholic, and she had sold him for a pitcher of beer at a bar. And afterwards, she had sold him to a woman that wanted to have children. And one of her, I believe it was her brother, had to go look for him to bring him back. So he grew up in this really dysfunctional household. But he also learned through his charm and through his magnetic personality and qualities how he could get people to do things for him and basically do his evil deeds. He didn't have to do it himself. And it was almost like a psychological experiment for him. Like, okay, if I tell this person to go kill this person, are they really going to do it? And so it just became, people became, were lost. They would find Charlie. He would kind of lead the way. And I think at the time of the murders, he had something like 100 followers. He was also a talented musician, so he was able to make friends with one of the Beach Boy musicians, and was able to even get Terry Melcher to consider his music. And he just kind of found a way to kind of place himself in other people's lives. But then at the same time, because he was mentally ill, if he felt slighted by somebody, he wanted to get revenge against them. And it, you know, he just went to the extreme of telling the Manson followers, okay, go in there and just, you know, kill everybody. And then after the killings happened, he wasn't happy. He thought that they did a messy job. And that's the next night they went and killed the grocery store executive, the LaBiancas, and killed them as well. And the police still didn't know it was him. And not until they were arrested in Death Valley for, like, grand theft and something else, did they actually figure out that they had something to do with Sharon Tate's murder.
The fact that those family members, and I don't know, you know, many of them, but the four that were involved in these murders were pretty high profile because of the trial and the story that went along with it. They seemed loyal to the death. They were Charlie Manson's people, and they lied for him. They killed for him. They would have done anything for him. Again, there's a magnetism there, mentally ill or not, that he had that allowed him to exert this kind of control over people.
Well, it's almost like there's the one side, like if you look at it purely from a realistic perspective, like there's always a ringleader when you're dealing with like addiction. So all of them were heavy into drugs, heavy into alcohol, and he was kind of like the ringleader. And when someone's on drugs, they were doing PCP, they were doing all kinds of LSD, they were doing all these crazy drugs, that it was easier for him to manipulate them. And then once they were there, because they all came from broken homes, most of them didn't get along with their parents, that he fed on their insecurities and said, you know, well, I love you, I'm going to take care of you, that they just followed him to the end. And so it's a very kind of weird psychological way to look at it. But then from a karmic perspective, it's like they have these weird karmic ties with each other. And even them choosing Sharon, would state in an interview just before she died, she said, I think something more powerful than we are decides our fate for us. And my whole life has been decided by fate. That's how she felt. And her husband, Roman Polanski, had said after she passed away, and in his autobiography, he said before he left her, he had a grotesque thought that when he kissed her goodbye, he heard a voice inside him saying, you're never going to see her again. And so it's kind of like if you look at it from a supernatural perspective, that there's all this storyline is kind of playing out and how some lives were spared, like her friend Ava Roosevelt. If she would have made it to Sharon's house to have that late nightcap and her car hadn't had car trouble, she would have died that night. If Sharon hadn't have intuitively known, no, I can't have my two little sisters here, if her two little sisters would have spent the night at her house, they would have died as well. So there was all these kind of karmic twists of fate. And with Manson, I think some people are just pure evil. And he obviously signifies pure evil.
It's one thing to call someone evil, and I will agree with you completely, he was evil. But it's another thing, if we look at that definition a little more carefully, was there something demonic in a spiritual sense about Charlie Manson?
I definitely feel that, and going back to when someone is like, when there's addiction involved, alcohol, just all this dark energy is around you, you have a choice to go towards the light or go towards the dark. And Charlie found that he had more power in the dark versus light. He tried to do things the right way, and he wasn't treated well by his family, and he was in and out of, juvenile jail, and just was really abused as a child. But he found that because he was so smart, that in the darkness, he could be, you know, the leader. Like, okay, if I'm going to be bad, I'm going to be really, really bad, and I don't even have to do any of the work. I'm going to have everyone do the work for me. And it was like he treated it like a lab experiment, like these were his little mice, and he was going to do these little tests on them to see what he could get them to do. And through that energy, he felt this sense of power. And that's like when I look from an astrological perspective with Scorpio energy, had like five planets in Scorpio, it makes him very intuitive. Like he can see people for who they really are. He can look at a person and say, okay, is that someone I can manipulate? Is that person have enough darkness in them to do my bidding for me? And so, yes, in a sense, that is very demonic in the way he chose to use his power, because that is the only power he had was when he was doing something bad.
Where does the Rosemary's Baby story come into this? There was some type of curse associated with that film and Polanski, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was like interesting that when Rosemary's Baby was being made, a lot of people were, you know, a lot of studios weren't sure if it should be made. Obviously, the murder of Sharon Tate was one of them. But also, just right after after completing his work, one of the film composer of the film actually died. He fell off a cliff in Los Angeles. Mia Farrow at the time was served divorce papers on set. The Dakota building where it was filmed, Robert Evans, the producer, would say, you know, the Dakota building is a very gothic building. And he said during the whole time he was there, he just had this very eerie, dark feeling about the building. And that same building 11 years later is where John Lennon was murdered outside the building, because John Lennon used to live there. And even Roman Polanski's agent at the time, William, and he was the one that had to identify the bodies, Sharon's body, and the rest that had passed away and had to contact Roman in London. When he decided to represent Roman Polanski at the time, he was only 26 years old, talent, up-and-coming talent agent. Everyone in Hollywood was like saying, don't represent Roman Polanski. He has this weird, dark energy about him. Like, he's brilliant, but no, you know, you should stay away from him. So he made a ton of money with Roman Polanski, but like 20 years later, one of the newspapers, it was LA Times, was looking for him, and he actually 20 years later was homeless in LA, sleeping on Ventura Boulevard in Sherman Oaks. Wow. Like, he lost everything. So it's just like all these kind of weird, kind of creepy twists of fate. And obviously Roman Polanski had several more problems after his wife passed away. And, you know, Robert Evans hasn't had an easy life after he did that movie. He was arrested for possession of cocaine. And another one of the producers had kidney failure. Like, it was just like all these strange things happening to people. And it's like, wow, either they all have really bad luck, or perhaps it has something to do with this film, or it has something to do with the topic about the film. But people really felt like there was always this kind of dark cloud following Polanski around.
Polanski's still a fugitive, right? And he's still wanted by the legal establishment in California.
Yeah, he was arrested, I believe it was about 12 years after his wife died, for raping a 13-year-old girl at Jack Nicholson's house. Right. Was having a party, and they got her to the party telling the mom that maybe she was going to be a model. And so he was arrested for that. He was in jail. He went to trial, and he was in jail for like 2 months, and they were doing psychological tests on him. And he thought he was going to get off on probation. And when he found that the judge was going to actually give him prison time, he took off.
Yeah.
And he went to France. And he's still a fugitive now. He's won several Oscars for different movies that he's done.
Right.
But in 2018, the Academy basically took all of his awards away from him. And, you know, he lives in France now. He's been married for about 30 years, but he still has a good relationship with his wife's ex-wife's family. They still support him, and which I find interesting, but he definitely has had a very troubled life.
Yeah,
after
I actually saw a documentary about that that whole incident with Roman Polanski, and he was about to strike a plea deal or something. There was a lot of things going on, and he was a bit betrayed, if I remember the tone of the documentary. I don't remember the name of it, though. JC, that song, Helter Skelter, that was specifically cited by Charlie Manson as being something that influenced him. Do we know what he said that song told him to do, or what the influence was?
Well, I just think it influenced him from a murder perspective. He, for some reason, like when he did the Manson Following, he wanted to try to start race riots, and he had all these different bizarre beliefs of things that he wanted to do. But basically, you know, in my opinion, he was mentally ill, and the music would speak to him, and he would think like, oh, okay, this music is telling me to go kill this person, or oh, I'm going to go have, you know, Tex Watson do all this killing for me. So it was just kind of like he had these people around him, and it's like whatever he said, they would just go and do it. And so as someone that has power, the more power you have, he just got worse and worse.
And when he became what we would consider to be a public figure for very nefarious reasons, you know, we see things like swastikas tattooed in his forehead. I mean, that came a little bit later. But, you know, the man clearly was very, very disturbed. And yet he was able to get, you said, at one point, 100 people to be what we would call followers or disciples or something. I mean, that is, I almost think there is something mystical going on there.
I definitely agree. Whenever I see, like in astrology, when we see someone having multiple planets in, for example, your sun sign represents who you're trying to be in this lifetime, and then Mercury is how you think, and Venus is how you love, and Mars is your energy. So he had multiple planets in Scorpio. So it was like almost like all of his chart was in Scorpio. So it made him very intense and obsessive and controlling, and also extremely intelligent and very intuitive. And he could have, like, if he went towards the light, he could have been this really great mystical figure. He could have, you know, been a religious person, be a priest or a preacher, but instead he decided to use it for evil. And part of the problem was, is like the California Parole Board said he had a history of manipulation. He was schizophrenic. He had paranoid delusional behavior. That's why he could listen to, say, Helter Skelter and think that it's like, oh, go kill all these people. But what was really weird is, like, when he got to Los Angeles, like in early 1968, he had met an aspiring musician, Gary Hinman, who was a music teacher, and he's the one that actually introduced him to Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys. And everyone thought he was really charming, and, you know, musically, like, they thought he was gifted and he might have something. And that's how he got introduced to Terry Melcher. And they were all kind of like impressed, like, you know, here's this guy and he's got these kind of group of followers.
JC, you're in LA. Do you live in the UK, though?
Actually, Eduardo, who does the intro to our podcast, is actually in London.
Okay.
And we have some of our production team members in London, so it's a co-production between the two.
So one of the things I find interesting as we talk about this story, and we talk about paranormal connections and hauntings and dark energy, is that one of the stars of a very famous, or popular, I guess I should say, paranormal reality television show, Zach Bagans, just, it was announced, bought the La Bianca house. Do you know anything about that? And it seems pretty interesting that it's attracting that much attention from somebody like Zach, who's obviously a paranormal heavyweight.
Yeah, I believe, isn't Zach the one that does the TV show on
Ghost
Adventures. The Travel Channel?
Yeah, Ghost Adventures. Yep, Ghost Adventures is
the name. So he has a museum in Las Vegas that he collects things from, like, you know, like, he's a huge Charles Manson follower. And so he has all these items or memorabilia from the Charles Manson crime scene and a bunch of things that he's bought along the way. And so I think he's really interested in the house because of the connection to Charles Manson and just his fascination with him and how this person who's crazy could get these people to do all these horrible things to so many people. And, you know, even though you were asking earlier about the Helter Skelter song, you know, Manson was trying to say, like, oh, you know, I'm trying to start this race war. Like, if I commit these murders, I'm going to say that black people did it and it's going to cause, you know, this huge uproar, which was just kind of an excuse, obviously, to get people so he could see what they would do for him. And it was because he was a schizophrenic. And when you're able to surround yourself with people that keep telling you you're wonderful and amazing, and he did have this charming side to him that he would be able to show for a short period of time and draw people in, and then he would flip the switch and show this evil side. And the La Bianca murders just happened because, you know, he thought that Tex Watson and the girls messed up Sharon Tate's murder and made it too messy. And so the day after Sharon Tate's murder, he made all of them get in a car and they went hunting basically for victims. And so they had been driving around for hours when they came across the La Bianca home. And then, you know, the man and his wife were killed there. So, yeah, I find it fascinating. I would assume that maybe if he's able to, he might turn it into some type of place that you go tour or something like that, like he did in Las Vegas.
The you know, the murders, the Sharon Tate murder and the murder of her friends was gruesome and horrific enough. But then the four Manson family members wrote in Sharon Tate's blood the word pig on the front door. And I think they did some other things. Was there a pentagram or something? I'm trying to remember. Was there more than just that word?
Yeah, it was pigs, and there was a pentagram, and, you know, not to be you know, for all the listeners out there to be so gruesome, but they even, Susan Atkins says that she tasted Sharon's blood and just they did all kinds of weird, sick things. And actually, when the murders had happened, Frykowski and his girlfriend Abigail had actually escaped and they were running down the yard, and Tex Watson and Susan Atkins got them and killed them basically in the front yard. And for Abigail, she had just talked to her mother like a few hours before she died, and she was actually leaving for San Francisco the next morning because she was going to San Francisco to celebrate her birthday with her mom. So there were all these kind of like last minute things that happened, and like little twists of fate, like Sharon saving her two little sisters from a gruesome fate, her friend Ava saving herself by having car trouble. And she said it was weird. Like, she did an interview afterwards. She said, you know, the engine light was flickering and there was all these weird things going on with her car. And she was like, oh my God, I need to go home. And then when she took her car in afterwards, there was nothing wrong with the car. So, you know, was there divine intervention there, because it wasn't her time, you know, her time to go? And then I found it really unusual that after these gruesome killings, both of them, the cops still didn't know who it was, and that, you know, they didn't find them until a few months later, you know, after they had been arrested for grand theft. It was Susan Atkins that started bragging about the murder while she was in jail to this woman, Virginia Graham, and she went ahead and narked on her and said, hey, they have something to do with the Sharon Tate murders, and then that blew the case wide open.
If she hadn't done that, if she hadn't been bragging in prison about being part of those murders, was there anything else that was pointing the police in the right direction?
No, and that was the surprising part. They were saying that they felt like the cops really screwed up. Like, there was multiple calls the night that Sharon was murdered, and no cops showed up. And the family that lived two doors down had called the cops in the morning to say, hey, the maid's here, and she's screaming, saying that the, you know, Sharon and her whole her friends had been killed. It took them an hour to show up to to the house. Like, if that would happen today, the cops would be there in like 5 minutes. It took them an hour to show up, and then they thought that the kid in the guest house did it, and they arrested him, and then he was released after 2 days. It was just all these weird, strange things happened, and you know why the cops weren't able to figure it out was beyond me. I just thought, wow, this is pretty messy.
Has there ever been any discussion from the police department as to an explanation for why they seem so lackadaisical when it came to those calls while the murders were taking place? They completely ignored them, and then why they didn't respond more quickly? Do they have an explanation for that?
Well, it was interesting. I was able to find the police report and after they had, you know, investigated, and what they had thought, because that particular home had a reputation for being a party house, part of the reason why they didn't take it seriously, like, oh, they're just probably having a wild party, something going on. There was a lot of drugs being sold through there. So the cops had like different scenarios. They thought, okay, the murder scene, it was a drug deal gone bad, and they, you know, took the drugs and killed everyone because they didn't want to be caught. Like, they had all these different scenarios, but it was in relation to drugs. And I think at the time in the 60s, it was kind of like, oh, well, if you're a party person and it's drugs and it's Hollywood, you know, they didn't take it as seriously. And what was interesting is that when Susan Atkins was bragging in jail, she actually told Virginia Graham that they had a celebrity hit list of other celebrities they planned on killing, because, like, they thought after Sharon Tate, they killed her, cops didn't come after them. They killed the LaBiancas, nothing happened. So we're like 3-4 months down the road, and they're like, oh, well, we could kill even more celebrities. They had Elizabeth Taylor on there. They had Frank Sinatra. They had Steve McQueen. They had Richard Burton. They had this whole laundry list of celebrities that they planned on killing, because based on the other two killings they had done, and no one, you know, was coming after them.
Now that Charlie Manson has died, and I believe one of the four that were involved in the Tate murders actually has been released from prison. Is that true?
Linda Kasabian never actually was put in prison because she basically testified against everyone. And I know that several of them have come up for parole. I believe Susan Atkins passed away. But I think the other, Tex Watson's still in jail, and I think one of the others is in jail as well. But Linda Kasabian changed her name, and she lives somewhere on the East Coast.
And we know that a book was written about this whole incident called Helter Skelter, written by one of the attorneys involved. And there are people now that are actually saying that, that some of what was reported was actually inaccurate, and there might have been some government involvement in this. Do you know of any of that? Does any of that ring true?
I did see a little bit about that in my investigation, but when I was reading the police report, the actual physical police report on all the information that they gathered, I just felt like the police were going down a path based on what I could read, that they really thought it was like had to do with drugs, and it had to do with a drug deal gone bad, and they somehow felt like Roman Polanski was involved, and maybe he owed somebody some money, and they were coming to get him. And so they were kind of going down this complete path of, oh, this is drug-related, and these are, you know, drug gangs. And so I think that's why it took them so long to capture Charles Manson, because they just thought, you know, they were very one-sided in their view of what's going on. As far as the government being involved, I didn't find any information on that.
Yeah. You know, obviously this is a story that has stuck with the public consciousness. It is one of those stories of legend. People seem to have an intrinsic knowledge of it because it's part of our culture. When we have a story like that, is it something that we can learn from in any way?
I think so. I mean, I think from, you know, what I found interesting about Sharon Tate is, like, she was incredibly, obviously, she was incredibly beautiful. She was an Aquarius. She had this really unique energy, but all of her family and friends would describe her as very personable, very charming, great sense of humor. And she almost felt like her beauty was a curse. When she started the movie Valley of the Dolls, her character was loosely based on Marilyn Monroe. And so she really had that kind of bittersweet, like I saw like very similar between her and Marilyn Monroe. They had, you know, they would choose men that weren't really right for them. And, you know, they were these beautiful women and everybody was using them for different reasons. And I think for me, it's like when you look at celebrities, I mean, there's usually something, not everybody's life is perfect. And if you look under the hood or you open the door, you're going to see a lot of dark things going on. Her mom at the time when she decided to get into acting was really paranoid for her daughter and worried about the casting couch and was always, always worried that something was going to happen to her daughter. And whether she psychically knew that her daughter's life, you know, was going to be short, but she couldn't protect her from what was going to happen to her. But they were all, you know, concerned, like, you know, do you really want to marry this director guy? And supposedly after he was married to her, he was cheating on her. And there was just all these strange things happening. And I feel like spiritually, you know, energetically, you know, who you keep company with is going to either attract positive things or negative things happening to you. And just based on the lifestyle that they were having, and they had this open door policy at their house, and Manson had been able to stop by the house like 5 months before he actually killed her. And she actually saw him and told him, like, hey, this guy is creepy. I don't feel comfortable around him. It's just, in my mind, it's way too many coincidences, and there has to be some underlying karmic ties between them.
We know where Roman Polanski is. We talked about that. Where is Sharon Tate's family, and have they spoken out publicly?
Yes, it's like the interesting thing about Sharon Tate. Sharon Tate's mom, Doris, became a huge activist for victim rights. And part of the reason why we have victim rights today is because of her mother. She was basically honored by President George Bush Sr. As an activist for her work. And the reason why we have victim rights laws in 50 states is because of her. And so she said that, you know, Sharon's no longer just a murder victim. She's now a face for victims' rights, and tried to take her death and turn it into something positive. Sadly, one of her sisters passed away of breast cancer at the age of 40. Her father lived to be, like, I think, 82. And she has one sister left who lives down in Orange County. And she continues to fight for victims' rights. And then she also shows up at all the parole hearings for the Manson followers to make sure that they don't get out of jail.
What's next for you and or Death by Misadventure?
Our next episode is going to be about Elvis Presley.
Oh, wow.
So that's going to be coming out on August 16th. And then the next one after that is going to be about Chester Bennington from Linkin Park. And then we're going to be starting our Unsolved Murder Mysteries in September. And our first story is going to be about Brett Kanter. And Brett Kanter died at the age of 25. He used to be an A&R rep for Chrysalis Records. And he owned a club, or part owner of a club, called Dragonfly. And he's responsible for helping sign Jane's Addiction and Rage Against the Machine. And he was killed one night after work. Brutal crime, and they've never solved his murder since that time. So we're going to kind of dig in and kind of see what's happening and why that is still unsolved after 26 years.
Well, JC, thank you so much for joining us again. It's always a pleasure to have you on the program. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
All right, welcome back to the program. We only have just a minute or so left, but we thought it was important to put this next caller on. This is Sherry. Sherry, you've got a story related to our topic tonight?
Yeah, I met Sharon Tate 3 days before she died. I was sitting on the front porch at 6620 Selma Avenue in Hollywood with her, having coffee, right after she'd been told by Maria Graciette, who did psychometry, and when she picked up Sharon's ring, she said, "Don't go home. Don't go home, you're going to die. It's horrible. It's blood everywhere." And Sharon thought it was a big joke, you know, and I told her, I said, "Hey, you better believe this lady. This lady knows what she's talking about." And anyway, Sharon Tate obviously didn't take her advice, and she went on home.
Wow. You know, would it be possible to have you back on when we have a few minutes to chat about this? Because I'd had some questions. And we just don't have the time to talk about it now.
What day would you like me to call you back?
I'm gonna put you on hold. My producer's gonna pick up the line, and we're gonna get contact information. And we'll figure that out. Okay.
All right.
Hold on the line for me. Wow, that's kind of a bombshell right there. And that's what this show's all about. That's gonna do it for tonight. Sadly, we don't have any more time. I really appreciate JC Nova being on the program tonight on this 50th anniversary of Sharon Tate's murder by the hands of four of the members of the Manson family. Fascinating. Crime in a macabre way that still has our attention today. Best of program tomorrow night. I hope everybody has a great weekend. It's Beyond Reality Radio.
Beyond Reality Radio is hosted by Jason Hawes and JV Johnson and produced by Alexandria Johnson and Slick Eddie Edwards for Entercom Radio. Beyond Reality Radio is distributed by Westwood One Radio Networks. Stop by our Facebook page and say hello. Follow the hosts on Facebook as well. For Jason Hawes, follow at jasonhawes.taps. For JV Johnson, follow at jvjparanormal. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Radio, or you have a suggestion for a guest, contact Slick Eddie Edwards at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com. Be sure to visit our chat room as well at beyondrealityradio.com. Thanks for listening.